Hello. I'm going to talk to you a minute or two right now, a little bit more than I do usually before we leap into a show, because there's a few things I want you to know. We're going to be talking about obituaries today, a subject very close to my heart, for reasons that you'll see, I guess. And the occasion for doing that is that the movie Obit is available now on Amazon Prime. There's going to be a special showing at the Wilton Library. We'll tell you about that in just a second, too. The movie Obit is about really the most elite form of obit writing. The New York Times uses some of its best writers as obit writers. When you've accomplished a lot in other forums, other areas of the New York Times, you can get to be an obit writer. That's not the way it is in almost anywhere else, really. And I want you to understand that before we plunge into the New York Times part of this. Later in the show, you'll also hear from a young woman, a journalism student at Medill, who was asked to do a prepared obit, and what's called an advanced obit, of somebody. She did it about me, which meant that I had to talk to her about that. Anyway, you'll meet Kate in a little while. We also wanted to talk to at least one person, let you hear from one person who's still kind of doing the small town obit writing thing. So you'll hear from a writer from Alaska who does that small town obit writing thing. But, you know, getting ready for this show, I read some amazing obits, like amazing obits. One of them was for a guy named Michael Elliott. The obit appeared in the Portland Oregonian. It had lines like this. After college at University of Virginia, he moved to Long Beach, California, where, among other things, he joined a semi-pro basketball team that toured the country playing exhibition games, dressed as women. But the kicker was near the end. It said, Mike ran out of family long ago and is survived by his ex-wife and best friend, Teresa Elliott. Though their marriage ran aground, their friendship only grew stronger, and hers was the last voice Mike heard. And the last thing she said to him was, Donald Trump has been impeached. Upon hearing that, he took his final gentle breath, his earthly work concluded. Now, so that's amazing. She told him this lie so he could die in peace. But so as you might have guessed, this isn't really an obituary in the sense of an obituary. This is what used to be called a paid death notice, except now newspapers call those obituaries because they don't have obituary writers anymore. They don't have obituary staffs. Because of what happened to newspapers, that whole thing has kind of collapsed. So an obituary writer like the one you're about to meet would want to know a lot more about the barnstorming drag women's basketball team. You have to have a lot of details about that. But somebody who's not used to writing for publication can sometimes do an amazingly good job in a certain way. So similarly, and this one shares the quality of an ex-spouse who stayed very close to and loving of the person. This is an obit for Colleen Sheeran Singer in the Bangor Daily News. She died from complications related to her opiate addiction. She was a drug addict for most of her adult life. And the obit writer describes what that does to a person. He writes, while Colleen was capable of great compassion and would give the shirt off her back to one less fortunate, she was also at times a con artist, thief, and liar. So you don't usually see things like that in an obituary. The guy who wrote this, her ex-husband, who refers to himself as the author of this obituary, he writes, the author of this obituary, who grew up comfortably removed from such things, thought he was educated but had no idea. Addicts shoot up to avoid being deathly ill, and because the disease heightens, also the psychological desire for the drug and the needle. Real addicts rarely manage to get high. They just scratch and claw every day to avoid dope sickness. Colleen wanted to get back into a methadone clinic, but LePage, that's the governor of Maine, and enough Republicans in the legislature said no to the Medicaid expansion. That's another thing that's remarkable about this obituary. He tears into Governor LePage of Maine repeatedly. And then at the end, he writes that she survived by, and he mentions the various friends and ex-boyfriends, and he says, and her adorable chihuahua named Squeak, and the author of this obituary, whose life was made more difficult, but also much better for having known her. Well, that's kind of a beautiful turn of phrase and a very complicated sentiment. But these were paid obituaries. They are, as I say, what used to be called paid death notices, as opposed to obituaries, which were written by the professional staff of newspapers. But for the most part, newspapers have stopped doing this. They don't have anybody delegated to it. The Hartford Courant has a wonderful writer named Ann Hamilton, who once a week writes a beautiful obituary for somebody. But that's kind of it most of the time. When I first joined the world of newspapers, the obit job was, for the most part, assigned to new arrivals, new reporters. It was kind of the lowest rung in the entry level. And the reason for that was, if you make a mistake in an obituary, people complain right away. So the newspaper could assess your ability to get things down accurately by having you write five obituaries of just everyday people. Because if you screw up, the family will call the newspaper right away. That's how most newspapers handled that. And most of them don't even do that anymore. But there's an exception. There are a few exceptions, but the most notable one really is the New York Times. They have some, I mean, basically, if you've accomplished a lot somewhere else at the New York Times, maybe you get to go and join this elite monkish staff of obit writers. So we're going to talk about that today, as well as the other things that I mentioned. Bruce Weber is joining us. He's been on the show before, but he wrote obituaries for the New York Times for 8 years until he retired last August. He still writes advance obits. Those are the obits written for people who aren't dead yet for the Times on a freelance basis. Also joining us, Vanessa Gould produced and directed the documentary Obit, which is now available on iTunes and Amazon, places like that. If you have Amazon Prime, you can watch it for free. And it will be screened, and Vanessa Gould will give a talk as part of the New Perspectives film series at the Wilton Library in Wilton, Connecticut on Saturday night, September 9th. Check the wiltonlibrary.org for more details and to register. Okay, that's enough of me talking. I'm going to start with Bruce Weber. Hi, Bruce. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Colin. Nice to talk to you again. So, did you say that I was monkish?
Yeah, I think there is something monkish about, at least about the world depicted in the movie Obit, in which you are one of the principal players. By monkish, I mean, and I think you would be the first to say this, compared to the other things that you've done as a newspaper writer, which occasionally I've been even quite intrepid, this is work where you rarely leave the New York Times building, correct?
Yeah, well, we are sort of sequestered. That's true. I would, I'd have to agree with that.
I want to ask you, first of all, about sort of who gets to be commemorated in this particular way. There are obvious people who are going to get big obits, and you've written a lot of those big obits, whether it's Yogi Berra or Edward Albee. But then there's a lot of other people who maybe aren't super famous, but who deserve to be and are commemorated. Is there a way you can kind of describe the criteria for that?
Yeah, I can, but let me give a little background here.
Sure.
First. I mean, the interesting thing that you were saying about you know, the people, the obits that are now published in small papers, or that have always been published in small papers, the choices, everybody has to sort of decide what belongs in their paper. And in those small papers, those regional papers, they commemorate the people who read that newspaper and lived in the, you know, lived within the localities that those newspapers covered. The Times thinks of itself, you know, for good or ill these days, as an international paper, which kind of expands the territory that that they need to cover. Bill McDonald, who is the obituaries editor, liked to say that, you know, there are about between 55 and 60 million people who die every year. It's about the population of Italy. And the New York Times writes obituaries of about 12 or 1,300 of them, so that there's a significant amount of triage that has to go on, a fairly substantial selection process, which is, I guess, the question you were asking is how do we winnow that down? And the answer is basically that, we consider obituaries to be news stories. And so the way we judge is whether the death of a person is of news value. It gets a little more complicated than that because obituaries are different from stories in other sections of the newspaper in that the news is always the same. somebody died. And so the value, the decision about the news value of that is what you're going to say next, is why the demise of this person is consequential to the people who are going to be reading the newspaper. And that's really the question that we ask. Is the life of the person who died going to be of interest to the general reader of the New York Times? Is it going to be helpful? Is it going to be interesting? Is it going to be informative?
Although, I mean, I think sometimes it's going to be interesting and informative, not because the person, him or herself, is legendary, but, I mean, I for those of us who really love New York Times obituaries, speaking for only for myself, I guess, but also for the poet Billy Collins, with whom I had a long conversation about this,
okay.
we love the obituaries about people that we've never heard of who have been responsible for something that we have heard of. So, for example, your colleague Marguerite Fox, I think, wrote an obituary of the guy who invented the barcode, you know, and got into exactly how he thought up the idea for the barcode. He was drawing lines in the sand on the beach or something. You wrote an obit for a guy who has a kind of disputed claim to authorship of the Hokey Pokey, right?
Correct. Robert Deegan.
Yeah. And so tell that story. Just tell the story of putting that together, because one of the problems facing you with that obit is he doesn't have a clear claim to the Hokey Pokey.
Right. Well, he did have a copyright for it. And the problem, as I... You know, it was easy to document the fact that he had a copyright for the Hokey Pokey, but then it turned out that there were other, there were recordings of similar songs and other claims that could be of similar melodies that could be documented that went back at least a century. So there were soldier songs in both the United States and Britain. There were other songs that were written, one in Ireland and one other one here in the United States that were very similar. There were a number of lawsuits involved over this. It's undisputed that Mr. Deegan wrote a version of the song, but whether he may have borrowed it from somebody else, whether somebody else may have borrowed it from him, that's sort of the thing that's up in the air,
right? And
there was a kind of down the rabbit hole sense that I got during the research, because every time I turned around, there was another sort of claim to originality by someone else, and it came earlier and then earlier and then earlier. It was quite an interesting story.
It was, and you did go down the rabbit hole and explore the connections between the phrase Hokey Pokey and the phrase Hocus Pocus, and
right.
In many respects, it was more an obit about the song and its complicated history, and then it was about the 104-year life, I think, of this particular guy. I did notice that the headline, and I think your headline writers have their own kind of fun with this. This is Robert Deegan, who had a hand in the Hokey Pokey,
right,
dies at 104. The other day or a few weeks ago, there was one that said William J. L. Sladen, expert on penguin libidos, is dead at 96. Now, there probably were lots of ways that you could describe William J. L. Sladen, but could you say something about that? I often feel as though the headline writers, in some of these slightly more whimsical obituaries, if that's the right word, whimsical, are having their own little bit of fun, too.
Well, you know, listen, like any section of the newspaper, the obits, any writer and any headline writer and the editors, they want you to read the story. Mm-hmm. So you want the story to be well-written, you want you want the lead to be inviting, and you want the headline to pique readers' curiosity to get them to look at the story. So if it's clever in addition to accurate, so much the better, you know.
So, Vanessa Gould, I want to add you to this conversation. How did you come to be making a movie about this particular topic, this group of people who are keeping the standards of obit writing so colorfully alive?
Well, first, hi, Bruce.
Hi, Vanessa. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I've got Jack Cadden here with me.
Jack Cadden.
Oh, tell him I said hi.
Yeah, Jack Cadden, who's an editor there at the Times, also a former editor of mine at the Hartford Courant, also featured in this movie. Vanessa, tell us about the genesis of this. How did you choose this topic?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a long story, but in sort of the concisest way, it was a story that kind of found me. I really didn't know anything about obituaries, whether the small town kind or the kind that were written in the Times. But one of the subjects of a film that I had made a couple of years ago passed away, and he was an unknown artist. But I sent a bunch of announcements to newspapers around the world about his death, just in a knee-jerk kind of way, you know, within the hours after he died. And the only paper that was interested in talking to me was, in fact, the Times, which seemed to me the greatest stretch of all. Marguerite Fox, who's still at the Times, called me, and the process of trying to sort of piece his life together just days after he had died, and some of the problems we encountered and the emotions that came up that went far beyond just simple grief or mourning, really kind of arrested me. And then I obviously started to look at the obituaries page in the Times on a daily basis, and saw that there was some pretty amazing cultural anthropology at work. And I was pretty amazed at the fact of how, just, you know, getting to like what you guys have been talking about, how rich history is when you sort of look, and how much we forget.
So the
documentary filmmaker in me, you know, was sort of like, okay, this is absolutely riveting. And I put most of the other ideas that I was working on aside and approached the Times.
So we'll play a little clip of this. In this clip, you're going to hear journalists talking about, well, basically what obit writing is all about.
The one thing all the subjects have in common, besides being dead, is that their lives had an impact of one sort or another. The word impact is infinitely elastic. That impact can be of world-shaking importance. You know, when Brezhnev died, that was the end of a particular era in one of the great social experiments of the 20th century, beginning of the decline of the Soviet Empire. And then you get to the guy who invented the slinky, and he had an impact too. Millions of people bought the slinky and took pleasure in it. If you weigh in one hand slinky and in the other hand Soviet Union, 20th century, obviously one hand is going to be dipped way down here, and the other hand is going to be way up here. But I'll bet a lot of people turn to the slinky first to read about it.
So Vanessa Gould, the maker of this particular movie, of which we just heard a clip, I am definitely in the slinky camp. I wonder, maybe that makes me a lightweight, but I don't think so. I think one of the things that newspapers have a struggle doing sometimes is documenting exactly this part of life, that you know, the huge upheavals in the world and the actions of kings and presidents are pretty easy to spot. Sometimes this stuff doesn't seem to even turn up until the obituary.
You're absolutely right. I mean, to each his own, obviously, but I think many readers that I've talked to now after, you know, working on this for several years echo the same sentiment. And some people want, you know, a complete picture of a life that they knew a lot about, but I think there's an intrinsic joy in really learning something new and seeing how somebody's life evolved and all the sort of twists and turns that may have you know, been a part of something that they did know about. And it's just a sort of a more human picture, I think. And admittedly, the team that worked on the film was also in that camp. And we had so much fun going back through the Times obituaries from the past 10 or 15 years as written by the people, the writers featured in the film, and reading their obituaries and really trying to pull out some of the below the radar figures and trying to bring those stories to life.
Yeah, you rapped too early to get the Penguin Libido guy, but that would have
That's
fit.
Not the only one.
Right.
There's so many that have come out since we locked.
And I love that. I really do love that. Well, one of the things you also explore, and we're going to talk about it with Bruce also in the second segment of our show, is the whole world of the advance obit, the obit that's written ahead of time before a person dies. And I know one thing that didn't really make it into the movie because you couldn't put everything in is that sometimes the people who write those obituaries die before the people who those obituaries are about die, if that syntactically makes any sense.
Yeah, it's a phenomenon that sort of just feels magnetically interesting to me, and I wish it had fit into the film somewhere. But to think about a paper like the New York Times, which has, you know, staff all around the world working on deadline to capture what's going on contemporaneously, here and now, urgent information, and then there's a corner of the paper where you can actually have a page of history written about someone who has recently died by someone who is also dead. It just seems like a wonderful thing to think about in terms of shedding light on some of the oddities in and around obituaries. And the way that happened is that, you know, two famous examples are Mel Gusso and Vincent Canby, who were both prolific writers for the Times, covered theater and culture, and they wrote many obituaries that outlived them and that are still probably on file. And what the Times will do then is have, a reporter update, add the information that's necessary when someone does die. And usually they'll share a byline or cite a contributing reporter to those pieces. But there's something just that's very, I don't know, it's a little surreal,
but can I throw in something here?
Yeah, Bruce, go ahead, Bruce.
Please.
You know, as somebody who has written dozens of advance obituaries that are still on file at the paper, I know you said it was wonderful when the writer dies before the subject, but I would like to say that this is not anything that I aspire to.
Right.
And nor does anyone who writes advance obituaries. You know, as much pleasure as this sort of thing gives you, I just wanted to let you know that it's not something that, that really is anything that journalists look forward to.
I can hear Jack Cadden chuckling darkly in the background there.
That's me. You're right.
So Jack, are you on the line right now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so I want to ask you something, because you and I worked at a different newspaper, and I think I've tried to emphasize this as much as possible, but it's worth driving home one more time. You know, I don't know. There was this guy named the Abbot of Sponheim who, in 1492, wrote an essay in praise of scribes 50 years after the invention of movable type, and what he was really writing about was a bunch of people who were going to be less and less important in the world, but he thought they should be really important in the world. And in a way, I feel like, you know, this movie is chronicling the remnants of a culture that used to be much more robust, right? You know, if you go to other newspapers, there just isn't anything like this unit that you guys comprised.
I think that's absolutely true. And in the movie, Bill McDonald, the obituaries editor, says basically we're the last ones doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, the Los Angeles Times gave up its obits team some years ago, and the Washington Post has shrunk its team, and so the Times is one of the last places where this is really done.
Which I don't know. I mean, as digital life makes it more easy to gauge readership, I feel like readership of really good obituaries, whether it's about David Bowie or the inventor of the Slinky, that's going to be kind of high. I mean, if you were writing stuff that you want people to read, don't people love reading obits?
Absolutely. I think that's true. And I'll tell you, when Leonard Nimoy died, Mr. Spock, yeah, that got more traffic on our website than practically anything in history at the time. It was really quite something.
So it's weird. It's sort of counterproductive to shy away from obituaries. It surprises me. I mean, I know that newspapers have had to drop all kinds of missions, but it seems as though they gave up this one kind of easily.
Well, I might interject observation that I've had for a while here, which is that, you know, one of the things you want to do is not write a Wikipedia page of somebody's life, even if it's done, you know, well. And I think at the Times, they have the benefit of these journalists who have covered so many beats and can talk to colleagues who know, have pretty unique insights into the complex lives that they're writing about. And they also have the morgue, mm-hmm. which allows, you know, at least this was something that I felt I observed, allows the writers at the Times to write an obituary that might not be possible by other news organizations. I don't know if Bruce or Jack wants to speak to that.
I can first of all speak to it, Vanessa. In 1998, my father died, and I alerted the Times. I had no idea whether my father warranted a New York Times obit. Rick Lyman wrote the obit. It had all kinds of stuff in it that I didn't know about my father, and I knew my father really well. It wasn't like he wasn't around all the time, but they had access to stuff about my father that I didn't have. So that may answer your question.
Yeah.
Hey, we have to take a break here. I'm going to get in so much trouble if I don't. Vanessa Gould, by the way, is the director and producer of the documentary Obit, now available on iTunes, Amazon, or you can go to the Wilton Library and actually meet Vanessa Gould. She's giving a talk on Saturday night, September 9th. We'll be back with more of Bruce. You're also going to meet, apparently, the person destined to chronicle my sad little life.
To celebrate in poetry. Obituary
while he drinks his morning tea.
While he drinks his morning tea.
We're back. We're talking about obituaries. We have with us Bruce Weber, who wrote obituaries for the New York Times for 8 years, is featured in the movie Obit. And although retired from the Times, he still writes advance obits for the Times on a freelance basis. You may also hear occasionally the voice of Jack Cadden, an editor at the New York Times, featured also in the documentary Obit. You're going to be Kate Cimini in just a second. I'll tell you then who she is. But before we get to Kate, and while I have that line open, I'm kind of juggling phone lines around here a little bit. But we had a call from Luther in Glastonbury, who I believe has seen this movie, Obit, and it affected him in a certain way. Hi, Luther. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Colin. Three quick things. First of all, if you look at me in my life, at least in my mind, I'm a little junior version of Al Franken.
Okay.
A funny side and a serious side. So my wife got this book, The Other Talk, which forced us to write our obituaries, rewrite our wills, and tell our children what we wanted for our final wishes, and I had some good jokes in my obituary. And then I saw the movie Obit, and I said, oh, yeah, I can't start it with when I was born and who my parents were. I put in an extra paragraph to hopefully draw the reader in. And, you know, I want my celebration to be a lot of fun for people, and I've seen ones like that. And that's what I want.
Right. Increasingly, these obits, which are often written by the person before that person dies or written by somebody very close to the person, if they have a sense of humor or a little flair, they often go viral on social media. All right. Now I'm going to introduce you to somebody who I heard from out of the blue, I think it's fair to say, a couple of months ago. Her name is Kate Cimini. She is a freelance sports journalist who's working on her master's in journalism at Northwestern University. Kate, maybe I'll let you explain. How is it that I heard from you? Why did I get an email from you?
That's a good question. We were charged with writing an obit for somebody who is from our hometown, and I grew up in West Hartford, Connecticut, and actually my grandmother, I lived with her for most of my life. She was a big listener of yours, so I heard from you pretty much every afternoon when I was growing up on WTIC, and then, so you were one of the first people to pop to mind when I was asked to write about somebody from my hometown, somebody who was, they said, not necessarily too close to you, well-known enough that it would be interesting to do.
So, Bruce, maybe you, as an experienced hand, can talk about what happens when you contact somebody that you're doing an advance obit for. I mean, as Kate will tell you, I did sort of the email equivalent of a sort of Munch scream or something. Bruce, in general, are people open to this idea?
Well, first of all, I have to say that if I can possibly avoid it, which I almost always can, I don't contact people who's
there. There you go.
Most of the time, when at the Times, because because we are looking into the lives of people who are, you know, who have had big newsworthy lives, you know, people who, if they died at 10 o'clock in the morning, we would have a miserable time cobbling together a comprehensive obit in a day's time. I mean, that's what the advanced obits are for. I mean, for basically famous, accomplished people, so that we don't get caught with our pants down when the unexpected happens.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily have to call Edward Albee up and say, I'm working
exactly
on this.
That
thing
being said, most of the people that we write obituaries about have been covered fairly extensively in other sources over the years. You know, many of them have written books of their own. Many of them, many of them have been interviewed dozens, if not hundreds of times. So the sources that you have to cobble together a life, in advance, at least, 95% of it, the significant newsworthy portions of the life are already pretty well documented. And that's what we rely on as, to write advance obits. Now, that being said, there is no law against trying to interview the person. I haven't had any luck with that.
Well,
I've asked three or four times fairly famous people to interview them for their obituary, and every single one of them has freaked out and basically done the equivalent of hanging up the phone.
So I didn't hang up the phone on Kate. I actually did agree to talk to you, Kate. But first of all, I'm curious to know what your professor was telling you about this. I mean, unless you grow up to be, or you're already grown up, but as you age into your career, if you turn out to be Bruce Weber, who's written about a lot of sports figures like Yogi Berra and Choo Choo Coleman and people like that, you'll be writing some obits. But there's also a good chance you'll never write an obit, because obits don't usually happen. At least they don't happen as much these days. Why did your professor have you do this?
I think he was really interested in seeing how we could write profiles, but he wanted to make it a little extra difficult. I remember at one point I asked you the my favorite question, which I was really excited to ask you. I knew it would be impossible. You know, how did you want to be remembered? And just the silence I was met with was beautiful. he really did suggest that we try and get in touch with people and not tell them that it was a profile. Tell them that it was an obit, so that it gave them the chance to understand where the questions were coming from, and it gave us a broader scope to dig into. There were a few people, I believe, who reached out to their subjects and said it was a profile. And all of them reported that they had a very difficult time just getting the full scope of this person's life, because all they wanted to talk about was their very recent work.
Right. Well, I think also, you know, when you asked me how I wanted to be remembered, one reason for the silence, besides just how appalled I was by having to think about this at all.
It's terrifying.
But also the problem with, and maybe it's a reason why Bruce doesn't talk as much to the people that he's doing advanced obits of, is you wind up being put in a difficult position, because I would like to be remembered in a very laudatory way as a pillar of the community and an upholder of the greatest principles and a brilliant user of words and a person who was right about things like 92% of the time. But I don't really know that I'm the most reliable source, you know. So one thing that you did do, you asked who else you should talk to, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you handed me off to Bill Curry, who the first thing he said to me was, well, I've met him two or three times.
Didn't he also try to convince you he'd been a private detective?
He didn't try to convince me. He did convince me. he really had me going for about 2 minutes. I was like, oh, okay, so a private detective before you became a lawyer. Good to know. He gave me some really like heartfelt stuff, and he also gave me some, he just kind of ragged on you for about 20 minutes. So right. Both of those were really enjoyable.
I was counting on that. So, you know, actually, I think we have to sort of conclude this segment just to sort of stay on the clock. So what we're going to do, first of all, thanks so much to Bruce Weber and to Jack Cadden and to Vanessa Gould. Watch this movie, Obit, if you like this particular topic. And thanks to Caitlin Cimini. We're about to hear Kate's work. Kate wrote this event, Obit of Me, turned it back into me as well as into her professor. So we've had it a special recording of it made for the rest of you to listen to. This is what Kate came up with.
If you're about to read this obituary for Connecticut radio show host and columnist Colin McEnroe, he had one request. Bring your jetpacks to a full and complete stop. You shouldn't even have your jetpacks running, he said. It's very dangerous. McEnroe, who has died, was best known for his humorous asides, liberal views, and putting the final nail in the coffin of Senator Joe Lieberman's career as a Democratic senator. Born October 15, 1954, to playwright Robert E. McEnroe and wife Barbara, as an adult, McEnroe wove himself into the landscape of Connecticut media. McEnroe hosted radio shows on WTIC and WNPR and wrote columns and reported for the Hartford Courant, as well as numerous other publications. As a radio show host, his opinions floated through tens of thousands of speakers, first as a drive-time presenter for WTIC, keeping commuters company through the interchange of I-84 and I-91. Later in his career, he gave them something to chew over through their lunch breaks as host on WNPR. McEnroe's record as a host was extraordinarily eclectic, jumping from one topic to the other and showing sincere interest in all of them. Bedbugs, whistling, NASA, Independent League Baseball all caught his attention at various times, as well as Hal Holbrook, the last of which won the Colin McEnroe Show a first-place finish in the Public Radio News Directors Awards.
So you'll be talking about income inequality, and then suddenly the topic is Norse mythology, and you're not sure how you got there, or that you have anything to offer,
said his friend Bill Curry, laughing during a 2017 interview. In 2016, McEnroe and his team at the Colin McEnroe Show began to stream the show to Facebook Live regularly, using an American Sign Language interpreter to give the hearing impaired access to the show. McEnroe was proud of this endeavor, saying that the point was to pioneer a method that other shows could easily replicate.
He is a deeply empathetic person,
Curry said, adding that he saw McEnroe as an egalitarian one as well.
Colin pays attention to everybody. There isn't even a shred of elitism about him.
Though multifaceted, McEnroe's work will always be intertwined with Lieberman's fall from grace as a Democratic senator, which began when Lieberman gave a series of speeches in support of the Iraq War, and McEnroe called for constituents to vote Lieberman out of office. Lieberman's subsequent loss in the 2006 Democratic primary and switch to the Independent Party was widely considered by the Connecticut electorate to have begun with McEnroe's interview with the senator. While a political commentator in the Nutmeg State, McEnroe was also known to delight in humor as well as the arts. Perhaps his best-known essay impersonated lauded New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani for McSweeney's Internet Tendency. He moderated celebrity interviews at the Connecticut Forum, and the Schubert Theater gave him spoken word performances backed by the Hartford Symphony Orchestra. I want to be remembered as someone who did something every day, McEnroe said. Every day should be different. You should be challenging yourself. Today's show, known by its friends as Sparky, or the show about obits, will pass into peaceful slumber in about 15 minutes. It is survived by its producers, Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The show welcomed one child into the world, Amanda Fish, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Jonathan Winters. Calling hours are tomorrow when The Nose discusses a new Netflix series, The Defenders. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to Colin McEnroe.
Go ahead and do that. So just if you tuned in the middle of the last end of the last segment, I'm fine, at least for now anyway. I'm probably going to make it all the way through this day. That was a prepared advanced obit by a journalism student. All right. So we're going to finish this show by talking about obituaries kind of the way they used to be done and still are done in some places. And we thought in particular a small town would be good to know about. And fortunately, there's not only somebody writing obituaries in a small town, there's somebody who wrote a book about it. And that would be Heather Lindy. She has written the book. Hold on just a second. I have to do this. I should have done this 2 seconds ago. She has written the book, Find the Good, Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer. She writes obituaries, has written obituaries for the Chilkoot Valley News in Alaska for 20 years. Alaska, where small towns are really small towns. So first of all, Heather Lindy, welcome to our show.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
First of all, give us a sense. Well, I mean, maybe just describe what happens when somebody dies in Haines, Alaska. Haines, Alaska is what we're talking about.
Well, what happens when someone dies here in Haines is that we know about it. It's a small town. Usually I find out from a family member or a friend, or sometimes I just know because they're my friend. Mm. And then the paper's a weekly paper, so and we also don't have a funeral parlor or a morgue, and so if someone's going to be buried, it has to be within 3 days. Mm. And so everything sort of happens at once. There's people who are planning a funeral, there's the family trying to figure out the service, and then there's the obituary and hopefully getting it in the paper in time to let people know when everything's happening. So that's sort of the first part about what happens, and I'm part of that because I'm the obituary writer.
Right, and I want to ask you about that because that's kind of amazing. In a town so small, about 2,500 people, I think, no funeral parlor, as you say, no morgue, as you say, no hearse, as you say, an ambulance crew brings the casket to the cemetery, but there's a professional obituary writer. I mean, there are much, much bigger communities that don't have anybody dedicating their skills to that cause in the way that you do. So why is that? Why are you you?
Well, part of it really is because the Chilkat Valley News has been our local paper now for 50 years, the weekly paper, and that's always been the editorial guidelines from the paper, that when someone dies in our town, anyone dies, it's news. And so our obituaries are very similar to, in a way, to the New York Times, in that, but we see every life as noteworthy and worth an exploration, or at least a photo and a feature, essentially.
And when
so
you
it,
say
it comes down to the paper, first of all, doing that instead of just charging the family and having them put the obits in, and then it came down to just having somebody like me start writing them, and I'm still doing it, and I love it.
So when you say sort of like the New York Times, tell us what your approach is. How do you write an obit?
Well, when we write an obit here, when I write an obit, we always begin our obit with how the person died, and then how basically sort of the story of why they were significant in our community, what people might know them as. And then I usually know that because I've lived here long enough. But if I don't, I ask some questions to family and friends. And then pretty much I spend a lot of time visiting with the family and with friends, with former coworkers. My obituaries always have three sources, usually two or three sources that speak about the person's life. Sometimes that involves, you know, double-checking things like military records or claims to fame in the lower 48. You have to sometimes be checked out. A lot of what I do is I'm kind of an inadvertent grief counselor because I spend a lot of time with families at a really tough moment. And at the same time, I'm listening and paying attention and taking notes for the piece I'm going to write for them. The other thing that sometimes happens, what I do, is that my obituaries, I'll often rewrite them to help the family with the eulogy and use part of the material and do it that way and write it in a family member's voice. Or lately I've ended up giving a few of the eulogies myself from the families have asked me to do that for some people in town.
So that's also a little bit different, it sounds like anyway, maybe a way in which it might be different from, I mean, those of us who have written obituaries, and I have written obituaries for newspapers, sometimes you run into the problem with of the family and the friends of the deceased confusing the obituary with a eulogy. And so they'll be saying to you maybe during the reporting process, well, you're not going to mention that he went to prison for 3 years, are you? And then I have to say, or had to say back in those days, well, yeah, it's a news story in addition to everything else. Yeah, I'm probably going to mention that. It's part of his story that he went to prison for 3 years. And that's often very painful for them to deal with. But I think if I lived in a town of 2,500, that would be a much harder conversation for me to have. I'd always be having it with people I knew. How do you deal with that?
What you do in those situations, what I do, is make sure that that material is included, but you have someone who liked the person or who was a friend of theirs say it, mm-hmm. instead of someone who didn't.
Yeah.
In other words, you wouldn't have, like the police chief say, oh, you know, he went to prison for 3 years. You might have his wife of 50 years say, boy, you know, when he was young, he was in and out of jail several times, but, you know, he cleaned up and became the man he is now or something. You know, you would do it that way. A lot of it, for me, is the source of the information. And maybe that's just a small town thing. For instance, I wrote an obituary for a woman who was a gold miner who used to shoot at her neighbor. I didn't have the neighbor that she shot at.
Right.
Say that. I had her best friend who said, oh, you know, you should see. Oh, she would just, you know, she had a running feud and she wasn't afraid to shoot. You know, she never killed anybody, but she shot over everybody's heads a lot. And they said that.
Yeah. I think that's a really nice way to handle it. You're not sugarcoating it, but you're also maybe not handing the weapon to the person who would be most inclined to dig it in for the deepest possible wound.
Exactly. And a lot of times, you know, especially when we know someone's personality, you know,
yeah.
Someone was really kind of a curmudgeon, you again, have someone who admired them say that. You know, he was really a curmudgeon, but, you know, he always donated to the... you know, the local humane society, and he had a soft spot for dogs.
Right. So, you know, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you begin the obit with the cause of death, which I'm very appreciative of because as a neurotic, I always want to know what people died of and whether I'm going to die of it too and all that kind of stuff. And you know, in the past, like 100 years ago, 125 years ago, that was a huge emphasis of obituaries. The New York Times obituary for Theodore Roosevelt goes on for 5 paragraphs at the beginning. The very first 5 paragraphs are how he died. But I know that you've had some struggles, at least occasionally, with your editor. Wasn't there like a 99-year-old woman and he demanded cause of death?
Yeah, that also comes from the longtime editor of the Chilkat Valley News, Tom Morfitt, and he recently sold the paper, but I'm still with it. Uh-huh. Tom just insists on cause of death, and his reasoning is that, you know, this is important demographic information. Are we dying of cancer? Are we dying of, you know, accidental death? All these different things. And as he puts it, even just to put heart failure, well, you know, there's very different ways to have your heart stop. And, you know, were you shot in the chest or did you have a heart attack or were you in your sleep and it stopped? But anyway, with this woman, there was a woman who was 99, hadn't ever been to the doctor that we knew of, lived in Haines. There's no hospital here. Died in her sleep, kind of after saying goodbye to everybody. And I said, Tom, you know, she just died of old age. And he really had a hard time with it. He said, there's no such thing. I said, well, of course there is. You can't just live forever. He goes, how do you know? How do you know that if people do everything right, they won't live to be 200? I mean, what's old age? And we've had this discussion around and around. And what we ended up doing with that one is I said old age, and he just left the cause of death out. She was 99 and died in her sleep. And that seemed to be good enough for him on that one.
So obviously you're an artist at this, and as you say, you're part journalist, part grief counselor, probably part some other things as well. That raises the question about your obituary. I mean, you write all the obituaries in Haines. Who's going to write your obituary?
I don't care. I don't think obituaries. I know this might sound blasphemous on a program about obituaries, but I don't think the obituary in and of itself is all that important. It's really the act of writing it and working with the family and sort of beginning the grief process and noting down some things that people might not remember otherwise, you know, the mother's maiden name or what year they graduated from high school or what rank they were in the military or something that might just be lost in family lore without the obituary. I think it's important to get that. But in terms of my own obituary, I mean, you're writing it now. You're writing it by the way you live every single day, I think.
That is beautifully put, and it's a perfect place to stop, and we have to anyway. Heather Lendy has written obituaries for the Chilkat Valley News in Alaska for 20 years. She's the author of Find the Good, Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer. I think you just heard one of those lessons. I'm sorry for those of you who called in. You had interesting things to talk about. We just had kind of a full play today, so James and Susie, sorry I couldn't get you on the air. Thanks to everybody else who helped out today, to Jonathan McPants for producing. Wolfie's been on the board making it sound good. Bill Curry actually played himself today, if you think about it. And we'll be back tomorrow.
Checking the obituary, see checking the obituaries like an anxious priest. Some make quiet passing, others lasting fame. I'm checking the obituaries.